The nuclear family is the single most important institution in any society. Without it, our very existence would quickly become jeopardized. Yet there are some who are attempting to break down the family, and by doing so, their efforts are an attack on humanity. Here are three reasons why the family unit is fundamental to society. Reason number one, the family provides for children. Research conducted by health professionals provides ample evidence demonstrating that a married couple is statistically better equipped when compared to cohabiting couples or single-parent families to provide a more favorable home for the development of children. For example, a medical paper by Wendy D. Manning titled Cohabitation and Child Well-being stated the following on health. At birth, children born into cohabiting parent families are more likely to have low birth weight than are their counterparts born to married parents, and more often experience asthma, obesity, and poor health than do children born to married parents. On finance, the median income of cohabiting parent households is about 50% lower than that of married parent households, and cohabiting mothers of young children have lower incomes than do married mothers. On behavior, children born to cohabiting parents have more problems with peers, more aggressive behaviors, more internalizing problems, and more negative teacher assessments than do children born to married parents. Instability, then, appears to harm psychosocial well-being. You can review the paper and supporting studies by following the link in the description. But the takeaway is that the primary purpose of a healthy family unit is to provide a home, afford protection, and support the general well-being of children. Without the nuclear family, the necessary regeneration of society would ultimately collapse. The home, when carefully balanced with a loving father and mother, is at its most advantageous, and it forms the bedrock from which sound-minded children can be raised. Learned values are passed on from one generation to the next. By both example and word, parents must raise their children to know how to live and interact with others. Reason number two, the family benefits a child's education. Professor of sociology at Princeton University, Sarah McClanahan, herself a single parent for 10 years, was part of the Fragile Families and Child Wellbeing Study, which examined the differences between 5,000 children who had grown up in either a single-parent or two-parent home. Dr. McClanahan revealed in a BBC article that children who were in what the researchers characterized as a fragile family, where parents were cohabiting or there was a lone parent, were twice as likely not to graduate from high school. The data showed that even a child in a stable single-parent household was likely to do worse on some measures than a child of a married couple. In an earlier paper found in volume 56 of the American Sociological Review, of which McClanahan was a co-author, the statistically unfavorable results in education for single-parent homes was highlighted as a considerable concern for the government, as education is a key factor in long-term economic success. The paper explains that the primary reason for lower educational attainment in these cases is due to single-parent homes suffering from income insecurity. Reason number three, the family provides for the local community and the nation. On both a national and a local community level, governments would do well to support and invest in the nuclear family, as statistically it is the most successful institution in which future generations are developed. The beneficial results from well-behaved, well-educated, and stable children is not confined within the walls of a home. Society as a whole benefits from children who grow up to be successful and have a greater sense of purpose than their own existence. Canadian author William D. Gairdner probably says it best when he wrote, "In the pure financial sense, the family is the original and still unequaled charitable organization of the world. No state could possibly match its contribution to the education, health, or moral training of its members, nor could it supply the young of the world with the equivalent in financial assets transferred from generation to generation." Research confirms that no other institution will care for the well-being of children like a family unit. Good parents must be unequivocally invested in the life of their children. Yet since the days of Plato, philosophers and politicians have been suggesting ways in which the state can raise children in an attempt to subvert the traditional family. In Book 5 of his Republic, Plato wrote the following: "Children are to be common, and no parent is to know his own child, nor any child his parent." The state-driven preferential ideas of Plato were passed on to French philosopher Jean-Jacques Rousseau and then to Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels. As a result, communism, and by default socialism, has probably been the greatest all-time net contributor to the breakdown of the family. Engels was clear in his desire to see traditional roles of husband and wife, as well as parent and child, entirely erased from society. The first condition for the liberation of the wife is to bring the whole female sex back into public industry, and that this in turn demands that the characteristic of the monogamous family as the economic unit of society be abolished. For some reason, the family is being attacked by key elements of society, and in doing so, our Western nations are unraveling. We need to carefully consider the benefits a family provides and choose, based on scientific observation, statistical analysis, and biblical wisdom, the best way forward for humanity. Choose life, that both you and your descendants may live. For more information, please request our special report on the future of the family. Visit tomorrowsworld.org for more articles, telecasts, and booklets.
Boys or girls? Which of the two are the most intelligent? Exam results suggest that girls are overtaking boys across the academic spectrum. But is this really the case? Let me begin by stating that it is not within the scope of this viewpoint to argue either gender as being more intelligent than the other. Rather, the question is, does the classroom provide an even playing field? Or are the current fads in education leaving one gender behind? In an article in The Province entitled "The Guys' Crisis: Boys Are Falling Badly Behind Girls at School," author Paul Luke states, "By high school, girls' grade point average outshines that of boys. In Canada, women make up almost 60% of university students." He explains the phenomenon by suggesting that for too long, the needs of girls were overlooked in school, and now that things are more equitable, girls outshine boys in learning. Recently, however, Dr. Jim Duick, author, former Assistant Deputy Minister of Education for the Province of Alberta, and former head of Accountability and Student Assessment, performed a revealing analysis on current practices in student assessment. The results were not only remarkable, but very disturbing, exposing what might well be an institutional suppression of the performance of male students. Dr. Duick based his analysis on the results of provincial diploma examinations written by all grade 12 students in core subject areas. These standardized examinations are used to determine entrance qualifications to post-secondary programs. Historically, examinations make up 50% of the student's final mark, with the other 50% being assigned by the course instructor. Given examinations are carefully designed to measure students' understanding of the curriculum, there should be relatively little variation between the teacher-assigned mark and the mark received on the provincial examination. However, as classroom instructional standards have declined due to significant increases in progressive or discovery learning strategies and less focus on direct instruction, it has been noted that teacher-assigned marks have been disproportionately higher than the exam mark. This is generally referred to as mark inflation. Dr. Duick took the analysis a step further and writes, "While grade inflation is a serious problem because taxpayers are not receiving the level of education they believe was purchased, they are also unaware that males' marks are inflated significantly less. Research now shows this discrimination against males is evident across North America and Europe." His analysis of the June 2016 examination results demonstrates that the mark inflation rate for girls was consistently higher in English, math, biology, physics, and social studies or history. Yet the results on the provincially administered examination had males scoring equal to or higher on 5 out of 6 subjects. Dr. Duick adds, "This advantage translates into more scholarships and placements in prestigious universities and explains why 11 Canadian universities now have a female population of more than 66%. Regrettably, as Dr. Duig points out, the tendency to inflate the educational results of female students seems endemic across Canada, the United States, and Western Europe. The result, of course, is the significant and potentially catastrophic loss of academic participation of males in the future. This not only will have massive economic consequences, but will also be extremely destabilizing from a social perspective. In my experience as a curriculum director for one of Canada's largest school systems, I have witnessed this trend. There is a growing body of research that serves to attribute the apparent advantage females enjoy in the public school system to their more compliant and passive behavior in the classroom. Males are more likely to exhibit skepticism about subject matter and to challenge their instruction. This behavioral difference, essential to scholarship, appears to be the source of negative discrimination in modern schools. As Dr. Duig points out, researchers attribute this female advantage to their more compliant behavior in the classroom. At issue is whether the knowledge of calculus, for example, should be conflated with classroom behavior. He wonders when governments will come to understand their responsibility in this mess and reduce classroom teachers' ability to hamper males from competing on a level playing field. Perhaps it is time for parents and all interested parties in society to realize they have become the unwitting victims of the ideological coercion of the educational new left. Perhaps people should seek to return to the cultural values that created a strong, well-educated, and stable society in which the potential of young men and young women is developed outside the framework of a system designed to suppress the potential of boys. I am Stuart Vahovich for Tomorrow's World Viewpoint.
To subscribe to our channel, click here. To access articles, telecasts, and booklets from Tomorrow's World, visit our website, twcanada.org. Does your life consist solely in the abundance of your possessions? Like many, are you stuck on the materialism merry-go-round?
Good morning. What a wonderful segue into my talk. As a young woman once, and a mom now, I understand that dads have an enormous role to play in the healthy self-esteem of their daughters. So this is a beautiful, beautiful teeter-totter. We have a crisis in our culture. We live among it. Sometimes we participate in it. We add to it. We laugh at it. We think it's kind of fun. It has become just sort of the norm of our lives, which is to dad bash. In the 1970s and then in the 1980s, we began using fathers as the butt of many of our jokes, and it was kind of fun. As we women gained influence and we worked harder at school and we championed ourselves and our fathers came behind us and championed us, along the way, many of us, as we started to feel better about what we were doing, we pushed our dads to the side and they became marginalized. And then those who are in advertising and media and so forth found out that there was a lot of money to be made by capitalizing on this. But this is a very, very serious problem in our culture. I put together a few clips just for you, because many of you may be sitting here, come on, what are you talking about? I've read some funny dad jokes on the internet, but is what you're talking about really that prevalent? I put together at random just some typical clips from television today, and I just want to make my point.
You drop your kid of a changing table?
Stuff just happens, okay? Last week, my kid ate a cigarette.
I caught him playing in the dryer yesterday.
I picked up the wrong baby from daycare.
Found my baby swimming in the toilet. No judging.
Hey, you little... jokes on me, is it?
What's all that racket?
It's a Lady Simpson, run!
Don't tell Mom.
Don't tell Mom!
Don't tell Mom.
Don't tell Mom! Don't tell Mom!
Grandma's helping me with my homework.
Oh. Want me to help?
That's all right, dear. We're working on grammar right now.
Don't like this one bit.
Why? What are they doing now?
No, nothing. I just realized if Dad's eating here, this can't be a very good restaurant.
Good toss. See, that's much better. That was good. You had your shoulder pointed, you kept your eyes on your target. Let's do it again. Watch me. Just like that one.
The durability of the Volkswagen Passat. Pass down something he will be grateful for.
It's funny. It's very, very funny. But when was the last time you saw a dad portrayed as a hero in an advertisement or a movie? The last time that I can think of that was in The Pursuit of Happiness, when Dad was actually a hero. Now, you see, this is funny, but for me as a pediatrician, who learned many years ago that if I want to do something important for children, I had to help their parents. Because once I help a mom and a dad, I don't have to worry about the kids. This is a very important issue for me, because while we laugh, it becomes part of us. We too start to laugh about dads. Kids are watching this. Kids begin to look at their dads as the butt of all jokes. If you could just sit in my office and see how kids talk to their dads, it's phenomenal. Dads are not respected, they're not revered, and it's an enormous problem. Why? Am I just making a big deal? Maybe I'm just kind of a stuffy person making a big deal about nothing. Let me tell you why this is really a national crisis. Because dads are the central figure in the identity formation of a child. Think about this. Think about when you were a child. Children, boys and girls, when they're young, when they're older, teenagers, even as adults, their identity is shaped by interacting with their fathers and their mothers, but we're talking about dads today. Kids watch their dads. They read their dad's faces, and they read their body language. And they're looking at their fathers, not because they care that much about their dads, because kids aren't that nice. They're very self-centered. They're looking at dad because they're trying to figure out some things about themselves. What are they trying to figure out? They look at their dads to say, Dad, do you see me today? Do you see me in the kitchen? What do you think about me? Men, when you walk in the door after work, your daughter knows and your son knows within 15 seconds what kind of a day you had. Not because they care about you, but because they need to know whether they should stay in the room or not. Right? If you've had a bad day, they're out. But they're constantly searching you because they need to figure out some things about themselves. Identity formation. A father plays a crucial role in a child's identity formation. The reason we cannot afford to bash our dads anymore is because it breaks children. The best research shows that toddlers who are securely attached to their dads are better at solving problems. The best research shows that if a girl is struggling with her self-esteem, the best thing you can do for her is not sign her up for better soccer or find her a better ballet team or hire her a tutor so her grades are better. The best research shows that the best way to boost a girl's self-esteem is for her to receive physical affection from her dad. Best way to boost a girl's self-esteem. Dads, when was the last time you hugged your daughters? The best research shows that when kids grow up with a dad in the home, not a stellar dad, not a perfect dad, a good enough dad in the home, kids are less likely to struggle with depression and anxiety, learning disorders. They're more likely to graduate from high school, go on to college, and go on to graduate schools. They're far less likely to be in drugs, alcohol, and sex at an early age. In short, dads are phenomenal for children. Finally, We know that the best research, a study started with 90,000 kids across the United States, looking at the factors operating in a teenager's life that keep him out of trouble. The number one factor keeping kids on the straight and narrow was not their peers, and it wasn't the school they were in or the church they attended. It was something called parent connectedness. Dad connectedness, mom connectedness. What is this all about? If we can just dig a little deeper and look at why the research is bearing out that dads are the crucial component to healthy children, it makes sense. The identity of a child is formed by watching dad, by reading dad's face. Why? Because every child needs three questions answered by mom and by dad. Dads have an authority in a child's life that is unmatched by any other person. Every child, whether they're 5 or 15 or 55, looks to their father to have three questions answered. One, Dad, what do you believe about me? What do you think about me? Am I good? Am I smart? Am I capable? Am I dumb? Am I stupid? And kids answer those questions by reading your face and your body language. Two, Dad, how do you feel about me? Am I lovable? Am I good? Do you like me? Are you ashamed of me? Are you embarrassed by me? Three, Dad, what are your hopes for me? Do you have hopes for me? Do I have a future, Dad? Kids who don't have those questions answered by their fathers live in chaos. I know this. I see this. You know men like this. Our prisons are filled with men whose spirits are crushed because they never had those questions answered by their dads. And we go home and we laugh at this stuff because dads, come on, are just dads. When I was 16, I decided I was going to go to medical school. My dad was a pathologist. I knew right away I didn't want to be a pathologist because he looked at dead body parts the entire day, and I was not about that. But he had a friend who was an orthopedic surgeon, and I thought what this guy did was amazing. This man brought me into the operating room, and I just thought that was it. From 16 to 21, all I did was focus on going to medical school. Graduated college, sent off all my applications. I was living in Boston, very, very competitive. And one after another rejection or ding letter, which is really a nice term because it felt crushing to me, came to my house. And after the final rejection came, I was convinced at 21 my life is over. I had no plan B. I had no backup plan. And I went out for a jog to figure out, okay, what am I going to do with my life now? This is bad. And I went out and I walked back into my house and I overheard my dad talking on the phone in his study, which was unusual because my dad was kind of an eccentric man. He was very much an introvert. He didn't talk on the phone a lot. And as I walked by his den, heard him on the phone, I heard him say my name. So, because I'm a healthy young woman, I eavesdropped. I stopped outside of his door and I listened to him. And I heard my dad say, yep, yep. My daughter Meg is going to be going to medical school in the next couple of years. And I thought to myself, what is he talking about? And then I thought, surely he's paid somebody off. But I will tell you the feeling that I had standing outside of my dad's door is a feeling I can capture now standing on the stage at age 57. Why? Because in that moment, my dad answered three very important questions for me. What do I believe about you? When you set your mind to something, you fly, and nothing can stop you. He believed where I couldn't believe. That's the power of a dad. How do you feel about me? I'm crazy about you. I always have your back. And what are your hopes for me? I hope that your dreams will be fulfilled. I know that your dreams will be fulfilled. I want to tell you, Dad, something. Years later, That my dad's voice resonated in my head and in my heart as I wrote my first book and my second and my third and finally my sixth. And when I went to my dad several years ago and I told him about that time, my dad didn't remember having that phone call in his office. You get it? Dads change children's lives. When you change a child's life, you change the family structure. If a child doesn't have those questions answered from their dads, they live in chaos. I know this. I've been invited to work with some professional athletes because these men don't know how to be fathers. You know why they told me? They don't know what dads do. They don't know what dads say. They don't know if dads are nice or good or kind or mean or embarrassed of them or ashamed because they never knew their dads. They don't know where to start. But that's the least of their problems. The biggest problem they have is that internally their soul is in chaos because they don't know the answers to their questions that their heart needed to ask. I want to just point out one thing, too. Those questions are not answered on soccer fields and baseball fields. They're not answered in concert halls. They're not answered as we drive our kids around to all these athletics. And they're not answered on a college campus. They're answered as kids live life next to a good man. Period. Are we missing it? Yeah, we're missing it. I started talking to you about how we're deriding dads, marginalizing dads, and we women, myself included, are leading the pack. I'm not here pointing fingers. I went to an all-women's college in the 1970s, and I will tell you, we had quite a ride, and we led the pack in proving that we could outdo men at everything. And ladies, wives, moms, sisters, aunts, we got a knockoff the dad bashing. You want a game changer in our culture? Let's bring back some respect for our dads. Let's refuse to buy the Father's Day cards that only talk about hogging channel changers and drinking too much beer. Right? Because it's crushing our kids. I started my talk with something that is not real life. I gave you videos of the persona that we have created year in and year out over the funny dad, the stupid dad, the dumb dad that all live in our houses, and we wives need to teach them a lesson or two. And if we forget, of course there are 11-year-old children to come along and tell dad how homework is to be done. If not, how he's to write a cell phone, right? But that's not real life. That is not real life. That's real. Every person in this audience within earshot of my voice has a responsibility to the child in your life that you love, whether it's your own child, whether it's your niece or your nephew, your grandchild, a child that you just know. We have a responsibility to restore respect and honor and a rightful position to every dad in America. You want to be a game changer? You want to change our country and our culture? Change our families by changing our kids. And ladies and gentlemen, it all begins with our mouths and how we speak to the good men in our lives. Thank you.
Do we show honor towards each other, or has society, in its failure to differentiate between right and wrong, also lost its adherence to a conventional standard of conduct? Do you live by the honor principle? When we hear stories about deceit, corruption, and infidelity filling the news headlines, it should make us wonder, where has all the honor gone? And we are witnessing a changing world where more and more people show less respect and honor and are too often indifferent or outright belligerent towards one another. In a book written by Robert Barringer, the author asked the question, "Where has all the honor gone?" And he writes about experiencing the power of the honor principle and how it can add significance to your life. This work explores and explains the critical need to restore and integrate this valuable truth of honor in all areas of life, work, family, and leadership. While we are not in agreement with many of his religious beliefs, we do see that on the matter of maintaining honor, he has a point. Mr. Barringer states, "To give and to receive honor is a basic human need, and there is a cry in the human heart for honor. So yes, people seem to crave it, but do they recognize that those they have relationships with also need it, and are they willing to give?" Barringer continues, "Unfortunately, our media-intensive world too often celebrates superficiality with focus on people like Lady Gaga or fantasy heroes like Spider-Man. Honor is more than fame or power. It is a spiritual principle and measure of character. And when we give honor to our spouses, families, churches, and nation, we help to build our communities." Barringer concludes, "The honor principle is not found on a list. It is found in the heart and must be lived." The word honor originates from the word esteem, meaning to respect and value. Do we respect and value those around us? Do we honor only those who are honorable? Are there daily situations where this time-proven principle should be practiced? The principle of honor needs to be applied regularly in the home, on the job, in government, and even on our roads and highways. There used to be a time when it meant a great deal to people. Men would meet on the field of honor and be willing to give their lives and die that they might retain their honor. The field of honor was known as the place where duels were fought, where men would stand back to back, pistol in hand, walk 10 to 20 paces, then turn around and fire. I'm certainly not condoning dueling as a means to defend your honor. But what it illustrates is that a person's honor meant something. They would go to their grave to ensure their honor remained intact. Women also once took great care to live their lives in such a way that they would never lose their honor. Chastity was one of the codes of honor, a concept not widely practiced today. Unfortunately, however, chastity has all too seldom been considered honorable on the part of men through the ages. A well-known United States military academy prides itself on being an institution where this principle has a high value. And those enrolled at West Point are still guided by the motto, duty, honor, and country. West Point stresses the development of cadets intellectually, physically, militarily, ethically, spiritually, and socially. They even have an honor code. A cadet will not lie, cheat, steal, or tolerate those who do. Now, those are high ideals. The honor principle is widely promoted at that institution, but no doubt there have been failures along the way. Sadly, though, honor is not being held in the highest regard or valued as it once was. The daily news is often filled with examples of men and women, leaders in their respective fields, who have come up far too short. And these individuals get caught up in their own weaknesses, and as a result, have failed those who once looked to them as respected leaders. In the end, their behavior affected their careers and focus. They did not lead their lives above reproach. They lost respect and honor and character. They did not make wise decisions. An ancient biblical proverb references the application of wisdom and its result. "Exalt wisdom, and she will promote you. She will bring you honor when you embrace her." Comedian Rodney Dangerfield's trademark was his complaint, "I get no respect." And though he made a joke of it, this situation can hit home with all of us. We've all been the victims of a lack of courtesy, respect, and honor at one time or another in our lives. But in order to receive it, we must be willing to give it to those around us, not just to those whose favor we seek. Honoring and respecting each other is linked with humility, which is also the method of obtaining true honor. As we develop the habit of giving right respect and honor to all of our fellow human beings, we will no doubt find that our relationships will improve. I'm Winston Goss for Tomorrow's World Viewpoint.
Subscribe and click the notification bell to receive updates about new content. Visit tomorrowsworld.org for more articles, telecasts, and booklets. In just 6 days, the State of Israel shocked the world as it fought against five surrounding nations to not only defeat their enemy, but gain a stronghold on the entire region. How did Israel win the Six-Day War? From June 5th until June 10th, 1967, Israel fought against the surrounding and regional nations of Egypt, Syria, Jordan, Iraq, and Lebanon in what became a watershed moment for the recently formed nation. What followed was nothing short of miraculous, as events swung heavily in favor of the tiny nation of Israel. In the weeks before war broke out, the mood of the Israelis was foreboding. And in the words of David Rubinger, a photographer during the conflict, "In the weeks before the war, there was a sense of doom. The National Stadium was prepared for 40,000 graves, and even if we thought we might win, it would be a costly victory." The Israelis were heavily outnumbered and outgunned by the Arab nations, who had over 500,000 troops, almost 1,000 combat aircraft, and over 2,500 tanks, compared to Israel's army, which consisted of 300 aircraft, 800 tanks, and 250,000 troops. However, a monumental amount of preparation was made by the Israeli Defense Force, or IDF. Military procedures were finessed and calculations were made years in advance to determine how many fighter jets Israel could have in the air at any one moment. The process of landing, refueling, rearming, and returning to the air was minimized. The Israeli Air Force could turn a jet around in 8 minutes and complete this procedure for all its aircraft up to 8 times a day. The events began with Operation Focus, a preemptive strike carried out by the Israeli Air Force as they bombed the Egyptian air bases. Egypt transmitted false reports claiming to have been successful in the conflict, which led to Syria and Jordan initiating strikes against Israel. Israel's preparations paid off, and by the end of the first day of the conflict, Israel had achieved air superiority. Over the next 5 days, the IDF went on the offensive on three fronts, advancing into the Gaza Strip, the Sinai Peninsula, the West Bank, including East Jerusalem, and the Golan Heights. Casualties for the Arab nations were very heavy and extreme for such a short period of time. Over 20,000 Arab soldiers were killed or missing, compared to less than 1,000 Israeli soldiers. A number of reports from the conflict recorded how Arab civilians and local militia confused the Israeli forces with those of Iraq. Colonel Uri Benari gave an account of this when they captured the West Bank town of Shechem. At the entrance to Shechem stood thousands of Arabs who waved white handkerchiefs and clapped their hands. In our naivete, we returned greetings and smiles. We entered the town and wondered, we are advancing and there is no disorder, no panic. The local armed guards stand by with rifles in their hands keeping order, and the crowds are cheering. I didn't comprehend what had transpired. Only later did I understand. The residents of Shechem thought that we were the Iraqi forces who were due to arrive from the direction of Jordan. Other eyewitness accounts speak of panic-stricken Syrian troops who became paralyzed and were unable to return fire, unexploded shells that landed atop a munitions vehicle, and the inexplicable lack of response from Egyptian and other Arab forces when fighting first broke out. In just 6 days, Israel had achieved victory over insurmountable odds and had tripled the area of land under Israeli control, including the religious sites of East Jerusalem. According to biblical prophecy, the Jews, who were largely removed from the land of Israel for the past 2 millennia, would once again inhabit Jerusalem. The scriptures which predicted this were written roughly 2,500 years ago. Yet we find ourselves today with a bitter Jewish-Palestinian conflict, which prior to these mid-20th century events would have been unbelievable. If a text from 2,500 years ago could accurately prophesy who would control Jerusalem, perhaps we should consider what this text also states. "For I will gather all the nations to battle against Jerusalem. The city shall be taken. Half of the city shall go into captivity." With a current population of around 900,000, the Jewish population in Jerusalem, according to the Israeli Central Bureau of Statistics, is just over 500,000. Which half of the city will go into captivity, and what other events will occur around this time? For more information, you can read or request a print copy of our free booklet titled The Middle East in Prophecy. I'm Jonathan Riley for Tomorrow's World Viewpoint. Subscribe and click the notification bell to receive updates about new content. Visit tomorrowsworld.org for more articles, telecasts, and booklets.